This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Welcome to Houston Sports Talk with your host, Robert Land.
Thanks for checking into the best Houston sports podcast, now part of the Believe Network. And joining me as co-host, Stephen Kerr, 65 plus years in sports journalism between the two of us. And it's time for another HST Classic Conversation. And Astros longtime GM and executive Tal Smith is now 90 years old. And in a couple of minutes, you're going to hear our in-depth conversation with Tal about his 35 years with the Astros and his time working with George Steinbrenner and the Yankees, too. Stephen, it's unfortunate that most Astros fans only remember him for the now-deceased and sort of mocked Tal's Hill named in his honor.
Yeah, it is unfortunate, Robert, because I know we use the term great baseball mind a lot, maybe too much. But in this case, that fits Tal Smith to a T. This guy really does know baseball. And, you know, you could put all his baseball stuff aside, Robert. I'll tell you what I love about Tal Smith. And I heard the interview when you first did it a few years ago on the show. And I guess he was, what, in his 80s at that point. Tal Smith has one of the great voices in the world. I could listen to him talk all day long. You know, not only does he have a great voice, but he can talk baseball with the best of them. And who better from a guy who's practically spent his whole life in baseball?
Yeah, he spent 54 total years in MLB front offices doing everything from farm system director to president of baseball operations. And in 1980, he was Sporting News Executive of the Year and UPI Executive of the Year after he took that Astros team to their first playoffs and that incredible series against the Phillies. 2 weeks after that, after being named Executive of the Year, keep that in mind, owner John McMullen fired Tal Smith. McMullen said, if Tal can't win the World Series in 5 years, he can't win it in 10. That was the exact quote. And it's crazy, Stephen, because this was at about the same time Bum Phillips was fired after 3 straight playoff losses to Super Bowl champions. Houston's had some brain dead owners. Yeah. Oh, my God.
And, you know, if you're a longtime Houston fan and you remember those days, yeah, it brings up a lot of pain because I'll tell you what, I will never forget that firing, Robert. I'll never forget how angry I was. And I was college age then. Okay. So I guess I'm dating myself here. I'll never forget how angry I was when I heard that, because that was my first reaction. How can you fire a guy who just led the Astros to the first playoffs in their history?
The Astros didn't get to the World Series. They couldn't win the World Series. It was Tal's fault that they lost 3 straight extra inning games to end the Phillies. They should have won that series. We all knew that. What was Tal supposed to do? Jump out on the field. And there was, we talked about the 80 series before. They had a ton of injuries. They had lost J.R. Richard in the middle of that season. It's like, imagine if Justin Verlander or Robert Valdez just dropped dead in the middle of a season. Like, what do you do right there? And I mean, they still should have gotten to the World Series even after all that. They had a 5-2 lead in the final game?
Yeah, 5-2 with Nolan Ryan on the mound, in fact.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Robert, here's an easy trivia question for you. Who was it that got the Astros in the position to be in those 1980 playoffs? Answer? Tal Smith.
Couple of forgotten facts about Tal Smith, by the way. His son, Randy, became the youngest GM in baseball history at age 29 when he took over the Padres back in 93. And then Tal served in the Air Force for 2 years and was a sports writer before he started working for the Reds in 1958. Stephen, it makes sense because he's always been pretty good with the media. He just seems like he's very comfortable there.
Well, he's very comfortable. And, you know, like I said, I talked about his voice earlier. The guy could have been in the media if he had chosen to, just with the voice he has and the personality he has.
Yeah, you're going to hear in this conversation stories from who built the first Astros playoff team, Tal Smith. He'll talk about it. He's going to talk about the first World Series team that the Astros had, which, guess what? He built them. Yeah. He's also partly responsible for the Astrodome, AstroTurf, and Minute Maid Park. We'll hear about that. And just a heads up, you know, this is just audio only. The other voice you're going to hear in this is my original co-host, RG Seal. So without further ado, let's listen back to this 2016 conversation with Astros 2022 Hall of Fame inductee, Tal Smith. Thanks so much for joining us, Tal. And that introduction, I said 1960. It all started for you 2 years before a Major League Baseball game was played in Houston. Can you tell us the story of how you end up here in Houston?
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a fun trip. A lot of great memories. I had actually started my baseball career late in 1957 with the Cincinnati Reds. Gabe Paul was the general manager of the Reds, and I can recall distinctly in October of. Of 1960, my wife and I and our young daughter had just made a trip back to North Carolina to visit our families. And in those days, I didn't have I had a car without a radio. And I pulled into the driveway, and my mother came out to greet us, and she said, "Everybody in the world from Cincinnati has been calling you," so including Gabe Paul. So I returned the call, and Gabe advised me that he was going to Houston to take over in the newly designated expansion club, and invited me to join him. And so we quickly turned around, went back to Cincinnati, packed up, and arrived in Houston in late October of 1960, and that started the journey with, at that time, the Colt 45s. And at that time, the team had not been named and whatnot. So we started then in November 1, 1960 was my first date of employment with the new franchise, and it's been a long run since then.
You were the farm system director to start with. What do you remember about building that Colt 45 team in the early years, trying to build a Houston's farm system from scratch?
Yeah, that was interesting because that was the days prior to the amateur draft. The amateur draft came into effect in 1965. But in our formative years there, starting with 1961 through 1964, and I was only involved in the scouting and player development at that time for the first 2 years, because in 1963, and this is another chapter, but I was asked to take over the project as a team's liaison for the construction of the Astrodome. So, but in 1961 and 62, obviously, we're trying to sign players and build an organization. There were two different concepts. One, some players and families regarded this as opportunity, because if you sign, you're not playing behind a backlog of other prospects in an organization like you would be with the established clubs. But on the other hand, you didn't have any identity yet, and there were people that didn't quite understand this expansion. You haven't played a game yet, so on and so forth. In the it stands in the local market, obviously, we advertised and promoted and worked very hard with tryout camps and one thing and another, and we were successful in signing Rusty Staub in 1961 and several other players that had great promise. Rusty was probably the most prominent of those, although Dave Justy is another one that comes to mind. I signed him out of Syracuse University, and he went on. He started with the Houston franchise and then went on to great success at Pittsburgh and St. Louis, as I recall. So Stan, we signed a lot of players, and frankly, during the first 13 years of the franchise, from 1961 through 1973, we signed and developed more major league players than any other organization at that time. So, we put together a good scouting staff, worked very hard, and sold opportunity. Joe Morgan was an early signee. Signed him. He came to spring training in 1963, sort of as an unheralded player at that time. Jimmy Wynn, we obtained in the professional Rule 5 draft why not? There were a lot of prominent players that we were able to corral in the early years.
Yeah, speaking of the early years there, could you kind of elaborate upon Joe Morgan? Because, he would eventually go on to a Hall of Fame career with the Cincinnati Reds. And then also another iconic Astros player, Larry Durker, came up around that time. Kind of what, and Jimmy Winn as well, maybe what these three players did you see the potential there early on?
Well, in the first place, the acquisition of talent is primarily the results of the efforts of the scouts out in the field. Too many times the credit goes to the organization, to the owner, the president, the general manager, and quite frankly, in a lot of cases, they probably aren't even familiar with the player at the time he first signs with the organization. So I think it's important to, in a sense, give credit where it properly belongs, and that's with the scouts out in the field who are generally unheralded. In the case of Joe Morgan, he was recommended and signed, as I recall, by Bill White, W-I-G-H-T. Bill was a former Major League relief pitcher, and if my memory is correct, I think we signed Morgan for $3,000. Obviously, Joe was rather small in stature, and that sometimes doesn't attract attention, but White obviously saw something he liked. But even there, I mean, Joe ultimately surpassed, I think, anybody's expectations, because otherwise you wouldn't have been able to obtain him for $3,000 initially. I can recall Morgan in spring training in our minor league camp in 1963 in Moultrie, Georgia. That was my last spring, because after we returned from spring training, that's when I started with the Astrodome project. But in spring training that year, Joe was just very competitive. He was the best ping pong player we had in camp, which would be part of the recreation in the evening for the guys, and obviously on the field just displayed great energy, great effort, and could swing the bat and quickly advanced. Jimmy Winn is another interesting story. I had started my career with the Reds in Cincinnati and spent 3 years there, and part of my duties at that time were to sort of coordinate the workouts of high school amateur players that we would bring into Crosley Field to work out with the club. One, to sort of establish a relationship with them, and secondly, also to get more of a line on their stands on their abilities. Although I do have to profess, workouts are not always the best way of evaluating talent. A lot of professional players can display pretty good prowess with the bat during batting practice. It's something else under game conditions. But nevertheless, we worked out a lot of players in Cincinnati. They had a very, very strong high school baseball program, and our scouts would recommend certain guys, and we would contact them and invite a few of them to come out to work out with the club at Crosley Field during pregame. And I can recall Jimmy Winn being one of those. He ultimately signed with the Reds, and we kept an eye on him. And after his first professional year, I believe down in Tampa in the Florida State League, we were able to draft him. And obviously that became a great success.
And then you got Larry Durker, too, right out of high school, correct?
Yeah, Durker, I was not. That's when I was still working on the Astrodome project. And one of Durker obviously signed out of high school and was an instant success. But that was his acquisition. The scouts involved, I think, were Jim Wilson and Carl Keel, as I remember. And they had to compete with other clubs to secure Larry's services. That was the last year prior to the free agent draft, the amateur free agent draft.
You mentioned the Astrodome, and you were working with Judge Hoffines and the Houston Sports Association to build the Astrodome. What kind of input did you have in the dome, and what was Judge Roy Hoffines like?
He was a marvel. He was so creative, just a dynamic speaker, great salesman. The biography of him is entitled The Grand Huckster, and that's pretty much what he was. He could sell anything. And frankly, he had to sell the Astrodome concept, the idea. I mean, at that time, the thought of playing baseball indoors was really sort of revolutionary, and there were a lot of skeptics, and it was through his own eloquence and his ability to articulate and to sell people that came into being. First of all, he had to sell the his local authorities, the politicians, the county judge, the county commissioners, and everybody else involved, and then he had to sell the public on the idea. I can recall the bond issues, the campaigns that he orchestrated, and then he had to sell his major league owners. I mean, frankly, it was his vision and his ability to sell and articulate that was responsible for the National League owners granting an expansion franchise to Houston in 1960.
From what I read, you were the one, though, that had to solve the issue with the grass in the dome after they had the glare in the roof issue when the dome opened, which forced you to move to AstroTurf. Tell us about that and other concerns that I guess might have been specific to the first ever indoor Major League stadium.
Oh, boy. This is turning the clock back, obviously, 50 years now, and a lot of memories. I had no background or training as an architect or engineer or anything of that nature. It never entered my mind, and frankly, after spring training in 1963, I was going to leave Houston and rejoin Gabe Paul in Cleveland as stands in a baseball role. Paul Richards had taken over the baseball operation in Houston after Gabe Paul left shortly after he came here. As I said, I started November 1, 1960, and Gabe left in April of 61 to go to Cleveland because of a disagreement with Hofheinz over the scope of Gabe's authority at Cincinnati. Gabe had complete autonomy. He ran the entire operation, and that's what he thought he would have at Houston. And when you're involved in something with Hofheinz is going to be a very dominant and very active participant, as he was. That created some problems between Gabe and the judge, and I can recall discussing it with him several times over lunch and so on, and he said, "This isn't what I bargained for," and he picked up stakes and left, and the ownership ultimately brought Paul Richards in to take over at the end of the 1961 season, and Richards initially wanted everybody in the organization that had previously been employed. He wanted their resignation, and he put together his own staff, and fortunately, the ownership, Hofheinz and Bob Smith and George Kirksey and Craig Cullinan, they resisted that, but still it was sort of a tenuous relationship with Richards, and there were several things we didn't agree upon, and I was going to leave, and Hofheinz called me in and asked me to take over the Astrodome project, and I said I didn't have any background or training in that, but anyway, I discussed it with several people. I called Gabe and told him what the opportunity was. He encouraged me to take it. He thought it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and it was. So I just made a point. I immersed myself in the plans and the specifications and learned as much as I could and tried to represent Hofheinz and the club in the day-to-day activities. You raised the question about the grass, and that was one of the memorable things that we had to deal with, because when the stadium was completed just before the opening of the 1965 season, we had exhibition games stands with the Yankees, and as players took the field for pregame practice stands a couple of days before this first exhibition during daylight hours, it was obvious they were going to have difficulty picking up the ball from what was commonly described as the glare of the skylights. That did prove to be a problem, and so the quick solution was to paint over a section of the skylights that were behind home plate that the outfielders would be looking into as they picked up the flight of the ball. Well, when you coat the skylights and reduce the amount of light, that posed a problem for the grass, and we found early on in the season that the grass was dying. We tried several things. We spray painted it green and tried to nurse it along, but that was obvious that there was an issue. And I remember the judge Hofheinz called me and says, "Tal, you've got whatever resources you need. Go find a solution to this." And so I dealt with that for some time, and this became a national story that had great awareness, and I'd hear from a lot of people with a lot of ideas. Some of them were, somewhat goofy. Some were from, people in the industrial sector or the agricultural sector that would suggest various things. My office was just laden with all kinds of samples and products. chemicals and coatings and surfaces and so on. And along this time, I had a call from the athletic director at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, Dick Thiebert. He was aware of the problem, and he said, we've got something that might interest you. And he said he was part of a committee of athletic directors that had a Ford Foundation grant to study the finding of suitable surfaces for playgrounds, particularly in the inner cities where they would get a lot of wear and tear. And he said, as a result of that, we've got a product up here. We've got a test installation at a private school. And so one of the architects, Jim Muller, and myself flew up to Providence and met Dick Thiebert, went over to this small private school, the Moses Brown School, and in their gymnasium there on the surface, what would be the playing court for basketball, for example, they had this product, which was green fibers that looked like grass, and we ran on it and bounced balls off it and one thing and another. And I came away with a conclusion, as did the architect Jim Muller, that this presented certainly a possibility of something that might solve the issue. And so that's the grass story.
Yeah, I remember Bob Costas once said that it was designed for kids to run on it in playgrounds, and instead millionaires would end up running on it in stadiums. So that's the story of AstroTurf.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What was your emotions when you walk into that Astrodome first game against the Yankees and the exhibition game, and there's President Lyndon Johnson and Governor John Conley, Mickey Mantle, the original NASA astronauts, they're all in the building. What did you think when you walked in and saw all that?
It's certainly one of my most memorable experiences. Actually, we stand the night before the opening, midnight that night. Obviously, there were several of us, the architects and engineers and people involved, still finishing touches and making sure everything was ready, and I can recall standing out in the middle of the playing field, right under the gondola in the center of the dome. And it must have been midnight or around that time, and there were still people scurrying around with finishing touches and checking this and that, and the house lights were on, so to speak. And I looked around at what had been created and just marveled at it. It was absolutely breathtaking. That's the biggest memory, not when it was full, but when it was, from at least from my standpoint, finished and ready to open. And it was just absolutely breathtaking. And then, of course, to see and experience the public reaction, not only the first game, but the first season. I mean, it was a marvel. What it did for Houston from a standpoint of pride, and what it did worldwide from a standpoint of recognition. It was a big event. I can recall during the construction days, and particularly as we got close to finishing the project in the early months of 1965, and stands of conducting tours for people from around the world, architects, engineers, politicians, you know, people that were really interested in this, not just from a spectator standpoint, but from a standpoint of envisioning what this could do as it stands in their country, in their city. Obviously, it was copied and emulated over the years many, many times, where, obviously today dome stadiums are accepted as common as and whatnot, but it stands in 1965, believe me, it was the eighth wonder of the world.
Following up on that, does that pain you right now to hear about what's happening with the Astrodome? And there have been plans to maybe do something about it, convert it into something, and then demolish it. People talking about demolishing it. I mean, it was the eighth wonder of the world. It was a jewel. It's still probably the most recognizable landmark for the city of Houston. What would your plan be for the dome if you were in charge or had that authority to say, yes, do this with it?
Yeah, it's a difficult issue. And I can understand it's been 50 years, more than 50 years, since the dome opened. And that means there's a couple of generations of people really that didn't live with it and didn't experience it. And as I said, dome stadiums today are not considered to be novel or unique. So I think there's a lack of appreciation from people that were born, say, several years after the dome opened. I think there's a lack of appreciation for what it meant at that time. To me, it should be preserved as a historic edifice. It meant so much to the city as a landmark. It put Houston on the map worldwide. Obviously, Houston was a growing city and had a lot to be proud of. But it was the Astrodome that got this worldwide attention and that attracted all these visitors and so on. And it was such a significant event from a standpoint of architecture. I think it needs to be preserved from a historic standpoint. You know, we've preserved, fortunately, a lot of other things in this country and worldwide throughout the years that perhaps no longer have any useful function. I don't relate well to the idea of converting it into something that is far removed from what its original purpose and intent was. That is almost demeaning. I think the present plan as advanced by by Judge Emmett and hopefully will be adopted by the county commissioners. I think that makes some sense. It changes the interior of the building some by removing the seats and raising the playing field, but at least you've preserved the shell. At the same time, it's an economic issue, but the numbers I've seen, I think this present concept doesn't cost a whole lot more than what it would to tear it down and demolish it. I don't think that's in the best interest of the city.
Hopefully it can be preserved. Well, I want to switch back a little bit more to the personnel on the field. And even though this was before my time, looking back as an Astros fan, having grown up Astros fan all my life, looking back to the late 60s period, Speck Richardson, who was the GM at the time, actually took over for you. He made a series of trades, and he passed away earlier this year even. What do you think about what happened during that period? Because I just look back on it and see Mike Cuellar traded, Rusty Staub traded, John Mayberry traded, and even, worst of all, like Joe Morgan, Hall of Fame career with the Cincinnati Reds. Able to keep some of those young guys there and with the other young Astros talent, and could have won, you know, several pennants. Who knows? But That's one of the things that's always been perplexing. Your thoughts on that and what he did as a general manager of the Houston Astros.
Yeah, that's one of the unpleasant memories I have. You know, as I mentioned earlier, that the first 13 years of the franchise, we signed and developed more players than any other major league club, and many of them were quite successful. You mentioned Mayberry and Staub and Morgan, and you could go on and on and on. Unfortunately, we dealt away an awful lot of that. Every general manager, I guess, has his own ideas and concepts. Speck was not experienced or well-versed in the player personnel aspect of the game when he was appointed general manager. His experience had been on the business side as a minor league business manager which is basically promoting the club and selling tickets and generating revenue. And in the early years with the Houston Sports Association, with the Colt 45s and later the Astros when they were renamed when they opened the Dome, Speck was really spending his time on his hands on the business affairs of the club. I don't think he was a very, very good evaluator or recognizer of talent. I remember I was just shocked at the Morgan trade, and I can recall Joe Heiling was the beat writer for the Houston Post at that time, and the trade, as I recall, we were in Scottsdale, Arizona for meetings, Major League Baseball meetings. When word came to me that we had traded Morgan, I mean, I supposedly was, at that time, was director of player personnel, but Spect did not choose to tell me about this or advise me about it. And when I found out about it, I was incensed and probably made some comments I shouldn't have. I remember telling Joe Heiling, who was standing there, and Joe said, "What do you think?" And I said, "I'm just devastated." I said, "Morgan's going to become an MVP." And sure enough, it was just a couple of years later, he won MVP honors back-to-back. And when I saw Speck a few minutes after the trade was announced, and I said, "Well, you may as well trade Mayberry now, because obviously the Morgan trade to Cincinnati, we got back Lee May, a first baseman, Tommy Helms, a second baseman, and Jimmy Stewart, a utility player." And I said, "You may as well trade Mayberry, because, you know, I thought John was ready. His path was blocked now by May, and so, obviously, you know, that was one thing. Speck did follow through on. He traded Mayberry." But I was just devastated by that. And you know, you cite other names, Mike Cuellar being a very prominent one, of players that the organization, for one reason or the other, gave up on. In some cases, it was due to managers not caring for a player. That was sort of the root of the Rusty Staub trade. Grady Hatton was the manager when Rusty was traded, and he sort of advocated that trade. I remember Harry Walker never thought Mayberry would hit. He didn't think JR could throw either. but these are things that you know, that happen. Everybody's got a different view on players. It's not an easy task, and certainly took a toll on the organization. I think if it hadn't been for some of those trades, we would have had obviously much better results in the late 1960s and early 1970s, and that might have saved the franchises. Turned out Hoffines became ill, and the club was ultimately taken over by the creditors, by Ford and GE, and then ultimately sold later on to John McMullen.
Yeah, I want to get to McMullen in a second. You mentioned Joe Morgan. For Astros fans too young to remember, he spends 8 years with the Astros. Then the next 5 years after they trade him to Cincinnati, he's in the top eight every single year in the MVP race, including two MVP awards. So, yeah, that really stuck as an Astros fan. Let me ask you, what was it like to be courted and to work for a young George Steinbrenner? Because you go from the Astros to the Yankees in 1973.
Yeah, George was interesting. I frankly enjoyed my experience with the Yankees. George was volatile, very competitive, sometimes could be terse with family and friends and employees and so on. I enjoyed the relationship. We had our battles, and quite frankly, George enjoyed battles. I mean, he might take what you think is an outrageous stance on something, and if you fight back or fire back at him, if you had evidence on your side or strong enough argument, you could prevail. I didn't have any difficulty with George. I didn't care for the way he would sometimes abuse people, but sometimes you just have to stand up and fight for yourself. I much preferred working for George than I did some of the other relationships I had. I thought the Yankee experience was great. George, I think, was misportrayed a lot. It was always the difficult side of George and how hard he was to work for. But George Steinbrenner was a very generous person. He was a very caring person. He helped more kids and more families and more people that were in some kind of financial distress, it stands, without any acknowledgement. He sent more, he paid for more scholarships, more hospital bills, more funerals, and so on, without any acknowledgement. He might fire an employee years later if that employee was in dire need. It would be George that would come to his rescue. He had a very generous side to him, and I have to defend him in many areas. He could be tough on managers and players, and sometimes just spoke out too quickly. But there was a pretty good heart underneath some of that.
In 75, you're hired back as the Astros GM, and then you build that memorable team that goes on to the first playoff experience for the Astros in the 80 NLCS season. What were some of the key moves during that time that led to the 80 team? What were the moves that you really felt like was the difference in turning that team into what it was?
Well, there were several. One, the hiring of Bill Verdon, who I think was just an exceptional manager. And he was able to take a club and really mold it together. They gave great effort. They were very tenacious. We were always in a lot of close low-scoring ball games. The Astrodome obviously was more a pitcher's park than it was a hitter's park. Runs were hard to come by. We didn't have a lot of power on the club. I mean, I can recall 1979 and 1980. I think Jose Cruz led the club in home runs with something like 13 one year. We were able with strong pitching and a great bullpen and speed on the bases, and wanted to manufacture runs and to win. And Bill had the ability to always keep the team well focused. I think you hear a number of players that will still regard Bill Verdon as the best manager that they ever played for, and I certainly concur. I think he deserves a whole lot of credit for taking that club and building it into the championship it was in 1980. The two key moves, I think, that we made in 1979, I thought we had two holes, shortstop and catching. We were able to trade for Craig Reynolds from Seattle as a shortstop and acquire Alan Ashby from Toronto. And I think those two moves sort of rounded out the club. Obviously, we had signed Nolan Ryan as a free agent for the 1980 season, brought Joe Morgan back, and he played a key role, but we had Cruz and Cedeno and Poole and Art Howe, and it was just a tremendous aggregation. I mentioned the bullpen, Dave Smith and Joe Sambito, both of who came through our farm system, picked up Frank Licordi in a trade. It was a club where virtually all 25 players contributed, and it was just a lot of fun. It's interesting that so many members of that team and want to have remained in the game in some kind of an active role. Bruce Bochy is a manager. Art Howe is a manager. Louis Pujols, who was a backup catcher, managing the big leagues for Detroit. A lot of people that have remained in the game, and I just sort of think that sort of speaks to the kind of personnel that we were able to assemble back in 1979 and 1980. We took a club that had finished 43 and a half games out in 1975, and by 1979 competed strongly, ended up a game and a half behind the Big Red Machine. And in 1980 we were fortunate to win the division and then engaged in that memorable five-game LCS with the Phillies.
Well, I want to get to the LCS in a second, but I want to ask you about J.R. Richard. I know this, you've probably been asked about this a million times, but what do you remember about that whole time? And it was just a couple of months, actually, before the end of the season.
Oh boy, you know that JR was—he was on the path to become a certain Hall of Famer. I've often said that when asked if I was responsible for selecting a starting pitcher for one game that I absolutely had to win, my choice would be either JR Richard or Bob Gibson. And JR was just dominating. And when he suffered his stroke in midseason 1980, that was just devastating from a personal standpoint and from a standpoint of what it meant to the club and its ability. I mean, frankly, we went into the postseason in 1980 rather without JR, and then during the playoffs we lost Cedeno and other injuries. But to get back to JR was just absolutely dominating. Deserves all the credit in the world for becoming the pitcher he did. I remember when we signed him out of Ruston, Louisiana, in his early years in the minor leagues. J.R. had control issues. He had to master that, and he just became very, very competitive. He was a scary guy for Stanford hitters to face. He's 6'8", and coming at you with that tremendous fastball and devastating slider and whatnot. He was virtually unhittable. He was a dominant pitcher for about 2 or 3 years there.
That LCS was considered one of the best series of all time. And I know you love baseball history. This has to be a real special series for you to get the chance to watch. Where do you think this playoff series ranks all time?
To me, it would have to rank number one, obviously, because of personal involvement. But even putting that aside, just from a historic standpoint, I still think it merits that ranking. I mean, the last four games all went extra innings. That in itself is unique. The great rallies, the Phillies in Game 5 score, what, 5 runs in the 8th inning to take a lead, and the Astros come back and tie it up, and why not? It was a very, you know, I thought both clubs were very resilient and showed the ability to bounce back. Number of memorable moments and plays, saying Game 4 with the controversial ball hit back to Vern Rule, whether it was caught on the fly, so to speak, or trapped. And whether it was one out, two outs, or three outs, and the long delay that ensued before National League President Chubb Feeney had to make a ruling. Game 3, which was a 1-0 win for the Astros, again in extra innings on a Joe Morgan triple, and just so many, many things. Controversial plays about Gary Woods tagging up and leaving third base too soon, and that run being nullified, just all kinds of exciting plays. I still enjoy going back. I don't enjoy the final result, but I enjoy the games and the plays that were made. And as I said, I thought it was the best playoff series of all time.
Yeah, I'm 8 years old when this series happens, and I still remember the Vern Rule play like it was yesterday.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey, I want to ask you, because this is one of the more bizarre twists in Houston's crazy sports history, and there's a lot of weird things that have happened, but from what I understand, in 76, you solved the Astros ownership issues by convincing the Yankees limit owner John McMullen to buy the team. But then all of a sudden, after the end of the 80 season, you go to the playoffs, he lets you go. What in the world happened?
I wasn't really involved in encouraging him to buy the team. What Dave LeFevre was a friend of mine. I'd met Dave when I was working for the Yankees. He was a lawyer on Wall Street, and he was representing Japanese interests and I was representing the Yankees, and we actually entered into an agreement where the Yankees were to provide consulting services to the Nippon Ham Fighters, one of the teams in the Japanese Major League, and that's how Dave and I first met, and we continued that relationship, and he came down and visited in Houston many times after I returned in 1975. And it was, Dave was aware that GE and Ford were interested in selling the club. And it was actually Dave who met McMullen through a third party. And the two of them worked on putting the ownership deal together. And then Dave and McMullen became estranged. I found McMullen very difficult to work for. He had inherited my services. I recall the first time I met him, I picked up Dave LeFevre and John at the Houston airport, and we're driving back into Houston. And one of the first words McMullen ever said was asking about moving the team to New Orleans, and I was just shocked by that, and and probably indicated that in my response. And then he used to tell me why not he didn't care for the Astrodome. Shea Stadium was his idea of a model stadium, and I obviously couldn't agree with that. And several issues that we disagreed upon. I found him very difficult to work for when I wanted to renew Bill Verdon and the coaches' contracts toward the end of the 79 season. He wanted to wait until the spring of 1980. I said, John, that's not the way baseball works. I remember Dave Smith, who was a fine relief pitcher for us in 1980, gave up a home run in Shea Stadium in August of that year. The only home run Smitty gave up all season long. And McMullen was just incensed about that. As I said, the 1980 team had to rely upon the speed on the bases. We had to be aggressive, which is Bill Verdon's style. Bob Lillis was our third base coach initially. And occasionally we'd have somebody thrown out at the plate. That happens when you're forcing the issue and being aggressive. You're not going to win them all. And McMullen would become incensed and want to fire Lillis, and we finally had to switch him for a period of time from third base to first base just to be able to retain his services. There were, when JR was still healthy in 1979, had to extend his contract, and McMullen was sort of opposed to that. I mean, it was just very, very difficult. He had inherited my services, and John came into his ownership the second half of 1979. I recall when the final three games in Los Angeles in 1980, before the one game playoff, and we're all at the Biltmore Hotel in Los Angeles after the devastating third loss on a Sunday by one run, and getting ready for Monday's game. And McMullen wanted us to make sure that they had all the players sort of a bed check in the early evening Sunday night. Well, you can't do that. The players have to go out to dinner. And he was just unreasonable from a standpoint of his baseball knowledge and familiarity. And I think he resented the accolades and the tributes that Bill Verdon got and that the club received, and felt that should be more directed toward him. So that was a path of stands of disaster, and I had a year remaining on my contract after the 1980 season, and John said he had no intention of extending that contract, and he didn't think it would work well for a lame duck situation. So best that I be terminated or let go at that time. So that's the way it was.
Well, third Astro stint might be the charm. Drayton McLean brings you back as the team president, and what was Drayton like? Because he elicits mixed emotions by Astro fans. You know this, Tal. He was key in helping the Astros stay in Houston, and the Astros had their greatest run of success. But, some people consider him short-sighted at times and maybe too miserly for some of the fans' liking. Of course, the last few years left a definite sour taste in everybody's mouth in the way he sort of exited the stage. What can you tell us about working for him?
Oh, I think Drayton deserves a lot of credit. When he took over the club in 1993, and from 1993 through 2008, the Astros had the second best overall record in the National League, behind only the Braves, who won all those consecutive division titles. and so on. The Astros, in the overall, I think, had the fourth or fifth best overall record, obviously behind the Braves in the National League, and the Yankees, and I want to say Cleveland in the American League. I have to go back and review this, but I know it was either fourth or fifth. You know, we went to the playoffs in 1997, 1998, 1999, opened the new stadium at that time, Enron, in 2000. The club didn't play well, but the stadium was a great success. And then 2001, we're back in the playoffs, and 2004, and then 2005 World Series. I think the overall results were very good. He was able to retain Biggio and Bagwell. I know he gets criticized sometimes for Mike Hampton or Daryl Kyle leaving, and he responded when we wanted to sign Jeff Kent, who played a key role, I thought, in the 2003-2004 seasons, and even though that was going to present a problem asking Biggio to play another position, you know, Drayton, if you made a persuasive argument, he was accommodating. It's the ownership's right and prerogative, and frankly, their deed to question what is being done. But I thought he was very supportive, and I thought the results spoke for themselves. Now, at the end of 2008, I can recall distinctly Drayton called his senior management. At that time, Ed Wade was a GM, and Pam Gardner, president of business operations, and myself in, and told us that he had an agreement to sell the club to Jim Crane. This is the end of 2008. Obviously, Stan, that deal fell apart. That was sort of a disappointing blow to Drayton, because he had the mindset to sell, had a deal in place, and then for one reason or the other, it didn't materialize. But obviously, that set in motion what happened in 2009, 2010, and 2011, when the club was ultimately sold to Jim Crane. Those 3 years, obviously, Drayton is focused more on preparing the club to sell, to reducing any obligations or liabilities that a seller might inherit. At that time, he didn't know he was going to sell to Crane. He was hoping he would be able to sell to other parties, and he was frankly dressing the club up for sale. That took a toll on the results on the playing field from a standpoint of the retention of players or spending of money for amateur draft choices and those things for which he's criticized. But he at the same time he deserves credit for bringing Roger Clemens in and Andy Pettit and whatnot. He spent money up through 2008. When it was warranted, and the results I thought were very, very good. We had clubs that, with the exception of the year 2000, competed every year and made the playoffs six times under his ownership.
When you came back in 94, it was the Oilers were leaving town because of the situation with the stadium and everything and the Astrodome. How strange was it to be at that point, over 30 years later, where you knew it was probably time to pull the plug on the Dome, the eighth wonder of the world? And how concerned were you about the Astros' future then?
The modifications, the renovations that were made to the Astrodome in the attempt to satisfy Bud Adams when he threatened to move the team to Jacksonville, where the scoreboard was taken down and filled in with seats, and the exterior of the Dome was changed with what I called the exit areas that looked like silos to me. I think it really changed the appearance. I think the ownership and management had let the Dome deteriorate some over the years, particularly as it stands in the 1980s and prior to Drayton's purchase in 1993. And you know, I think the maintenance and the appearance suffered, and the whole aspect with the scoreboard gone and so on changed things. So I think at that time, Drayton's desire and efforts to build a new stadium downtown, I think that made sense, and I think obviously it has worked out well. I hated to see the Astrodome vacated, but that had been 35 years or so, and that's a long time in the life of stadiums. I see other cities now. I mean, the Braves have had, well, they're going into their third stadium now, and I see up in Arlington, the Rangers are planning on a new facility there. So as much as the Astrodome meant, you know, perhaps it was time to consider something else. And ownerships want to put their own stamp on things. I suspect if the Astrodome had been built under Drayton McLean's ownership, there may have been greater efforts to to stay there and to modernize it and to improve the appearance and the upkeep. But that's just a fact of life. The Enron and now Minute Maid has worked out very well for the ball club from a fan standpoint and so on. And I think that's something that has certainly added to the city.
Well, fans would be disappointed if I didn't ask you about your hill, which everybody else knows is Tal's Hill, but now I'm talking to Tal, so I could say your hill. I mean, they name it for in your honor for your involvement in the ballpark, but, you know, there's just been the debate about the safety and all of that sort of thing. They're taking it away finally this offseason. You know, are you disappointed? Kind of what was your feeling on it throughout the entire history of Tal's Hill?
Yeah, again, you've got different ownership and different administration, and they inherited the hill and the name of the hill. And frankly, I thought it added an interesting dimension to the ballpark. Heard these arguments about injury. Well, it's been there now. This is the 17th season. There, to my knowledge, never been an injury that's sustained or occurred on the hill. I see more players, more infielders trip over the pitcher's mound on pop-ups or players getting injured in foul territory by tarps or running over mounds in foul territory where in the few parks that remain with mounds and inside the playing surface. If you're looking at the most memorable defensive plays in the history of the ballpark, I think many of them were occasioned by the hill. The Lance Berkman catch being the most notable one. I think that's a classic. I still marvel and enjoy seeing that every time it's replayed. I thought the hill really added an interesting aspect. I much prefer that to swimming pools or something of that nature in ballparks. You know, when you take the hill out, or frankly, when you bring center field in another 30 or 35 feet, and that's going to affect the power alleys too. And I'm concerned about what that's going to do to the actual game conditions. Some fans may recall when we first opened the new ballpark downtown in 2000, there were, if I recall correctly, 266 home runs hit at home in that ballpark in 81 games. And there was great concern about the field dimensions, that it was playing as a bandbox because of the Crawford boxes in left field and what is a relatively short vertical wall in right field. The games were high scoring, home runs were plentiful, and so on. And that's why I had maintained in the design stage that you have to compensate for the short dimensions down the foul lines with a deep center field, much like Yankee Stadium and the Polo Grounds, Fenway and other parks have done. You've got to compensate by giving pitchers some way to get hitters out. The depth we have in the power alleys and center field has proved useful. Pitchers soon found out how to use that to their advantage and try not to let the right-handed hitters pull to the Crawford boxes or left-handed hitters pull to right field. And why not? So when you change those dimensions, what's it going to do to the playing of the game? I hope it doesn't become a bandbox. I think it's played well ever since the 2000 season, and I'll be interested to see what effect this has.
I want to ask about front offices, too, because they look a lot different than they did a generation ago with baseball lifers, like you've mentioned, and they've been replaced by engineering grads and software people and IT grads, MBA graduates, and it's just very different. And the Astros is a front office now that's on the cutting edge of analytics. I just am curious for your thoughts on this evolution of the game to being a data-driven one, your assessment of things in that regard, and would you handle things differently if you were handed the GM reins today as opposed to several years ago.
And I know you like numbers, Tal, because I met you at the Sabre meeting, so you are a fan of stats a little bit.
Yeah, I think analytics are important. I think that's part of your ongoing evaluation. I am more inclined to look at statistics and analytics from a standpoint of explaining what has happened, not necessarily as a infallible prediction of things to come, because it's the game is still played by people and performances change day to day. I would use analytics to question perhaps evaluations. Well, you say this, but here are the numbers. What accounts for the difference? Why? Is there something we're missing? I've always been a believer. I stressed on base average many years ago, back in the 1960s and 1970s, when before Moneyball was written. I think that's always been an important aspect. I've always had an appreciation for that. I think analytics and statistics are a resource that you should certainly use heavily. When I returned from the Yankees, and we were the first club at that time, I think, to go out and hire a statistical consultant. And the analytics or statistical departments are much larger and much greater than they were then. I think it's something that has to be used. But at the same time, I don't think you can discount the contribution that the experienced baseball people, the scouts on both the amateur and the professional levels, make. It's still a game played by people, not by robots, and I think there is a difference.
As a talent evaluator and a guy that's been in charge of a farm system, would you have had the foresight to draft or bring in a guy like Jose Altuve? Could you have figured that one out?
he was brought in during the Drayton McLean regime.
Right.
Altuve and Keuchel and Springer and Castro, those were all players, and we traded for several others that are no longer here. J.D. Martinez was signed under the Drayton McLean ownership regime. And from that standpoint, why not Stanley Altuve signing? The only thing, stands that might have been something that scouts didn't necessarily embrace was his size, and that's sort of comparable to the Joe Morgan situation back in 1962-63. So, frankly, when at the stand, we did bring Altuve in. I saw him play at Greenville, Tennessee, in the Appalachian League, and he stood out then because of his energy and because of his overall abilities.
Best Astro of all time. Let me get your answer to that. And Cesar Cedeño is a guy that might be in that conversation, I would assume.
You know me well. You anticipate my answer. It's hard because, obviously, Craig Biggio is deservingly a Hall of Famer. Jeff Bagwell should be. Jose Cruz has had a long and remarkable career as a player. Just so many. I mean, as it stands, the pitchers, J.R. and Dirk. It goes on and on and on. I thought the most exciting talent that I saw in an Astro uniform, and I'm somewhat partial or influenced to the earlier years when I was more directly involved, I guess, from a, you know, I've often cited Cedeño. Cesar was just a superb talent. Unfortunately, career cut a little bit short by injuries and so on, but he was just a remarkable talent. I thought he was destined to be a Hall of Famer. I thought he was as close to Willie Mays as anybody I ever saw.
Yeah, my apologies. I forgot. Yes, Joe Morgan was also kind of doubted a little bit because of his size, like Altuve. And yeah, you brought him in. So I don't even know why I was asking the question, because that's pretty obvious. But hey, you spent so much time with us, and this is a great thing about what we do is we get to spend a little bit more time. And can't thank you enough for taking the time to do this. And thank you so much for all the years with what you did with the Astros as a fan. We've seen a lot of fun stuff in the Astros history.
I've really enjoyed this. You guys have certainly asked some very interesting and thought-provoking questions, and it's fun to sort of relive some of these things and to engage in this conversation. You've done a nice job with it, and I've enjoyed it.
You're listening to Houston Sports Talk.
Hey, don't forget to support us by subscribing and commenting on YouTube. You can always listen to us on Spotify, Apple, or your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends about us and share our show links on social media. Spread the word, everybody. Thanks for listening.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.